committee. Hey, I'm starting the meeting. Come on. It's late in the session, but we can't be that loose about protocol. We're going to start the meeting, and I apologize to those of you who were here a couple of days ago when these bills were scheduled and the meeting went long enough that we decided to hold these two over for today. So I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 24A. And I have Dr. Higginson, are you here? Or Katie King.
Uh-huh.
Substituting today for Dr. Higginson, it's Katie King. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Representative Williams. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am not Dr. Higginson, but I am Katie King, Intergovernmental Relations Liaison for Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And Dr. Higginson is tied up in another hearing, but he has asked me to relay the department's support of this bill. And we know all too well that chemical and biological weapons can cause as much damage as conventional ones. And the development and use of these weapons should carry a similar penalty to conventional weapons. We found out during the East Coast anthrax attacks in the fall of 2001 how disruptive hoaxes can be. In fact, at the time, instead of calling them weapons of mass destruction, we are calling them weapons of mass disruption just because of the toll that it took on public health systems. Even though we had no anthrax exposures in Oregon, calls due to hoaxes or simply suspicious matter in the environment, such as white powder near a toilet bowl, for example, cost the public health system thousands of staff hours at the state and local level. We are happy to see this bill that clearly shows hoaxes are serious matters that need to be dealt with seriously. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Are there questions for Ms. King? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First orienting myself to what's going on here, and so I guess I need a little bit of guidance. The language seems very broad to me. That is, the language of chemical substance or toxin. It would extend to many products that we all keep in our homes and in garages. What are the protections to distinguish between things that are done that would be criminally liable under this bill and things that a lot of us do when we just keep material that happens to be toxic in our homes?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer.
Council, can you enlighten us?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think on page 2, line 2, it would be the mens rea of the intention of unlawfully harming a person or animal. So for the way this, the first section is definitions. Section 2 is the crime of unlawful development, manufacture, delivery, possession, or use of a harmful substance with the intention of unlawfully harming a person or animal. And so, incidentally, the genesis of this, as I recall from the interim, was that there was an anthrax scare at the Capitol. And in reviewing that, and also in the governor's review, Governor Kitzhoffer asked the AG's office to review our laws for terrorist-type situations and for that kind of issue after 9/11. And what we learned from that was that our hoax destructive device would not apply to a hoax of anthrax or a hoax of a chemical substance, because destructive device is a bomb, more like that. So, as I recall, this bill first created the actual possession delivery of a real biological or chemical substance, and then in Section 3 prohibits a person from manufacturing, delivering, or causing a hoax destructive device as well. And so that's kind of the genesis, and that would be the limitation, would be the state of mind that the prosecutor would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that your intent was in Section 2 to unlawfully harm a person or animal, and then in Section 3 that if it was a hoax, that the person knowingly placed another person in fear of serious physical injury.
Okay. So the counsel, the thrust then is to expand the scope of what is already a statutory scheme for destructive devices and to include then biological substances and chemical substances and toxins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not to expand destructive device, but to allow for prosecution of both a possession, delivery, or development of one of these type of substances, and really, I guess substance is a better word, or a delivery system, if they have that state of mind of intentional, you know, their conscious objective is to unlawfully harm a person or animal. And then secondly, as you said, it would be allowing for prosecution of a hoax, but we're not expanding destructive device. We're allowing, if it's a hoax and it's an imitation of a delivery system. And that's on page 2, lines 26 and 27. So yes, we are allowing, you know, the prosecution of a hoax, but it would not be by expanding the actual definition of that destructive device.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions of Ms. King or counsel? Counsel, in the back of the bill, I note that there's also in Section 8 an adjustment with respect to menacing in the first degree.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. That's actually a new crime. Menacing currently is a Class A misdemeanor.
Menacing?
Don't get me in trouble, Representative Shirley. I've already made that mistake once or twice. Menacing. Menacing.
I don't know how you say it.
I know. It's hard.
Menacing.
Yes. Right. Menacing is a Class A misdemeanor. This creates a new crime of a Class C felony where the menacing occurs by circulation of a false threat of fire, explosion, catastrophe, or other emergency likely to cause alarm. And again, the mens rea or the state of mind for that is with the intent to cause fear of death or serious physical injury.
And counsel, would that include someone phoning in a bomb threat, for example? Would that be included in Section 8?
Mr. Chairman, that is, I believe it would, and that was the goal of this.
All right. Katie, thank you. Tell Dr. Higginson we missed him.
Okay.
Any other questions on this, colleagues? Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 24A? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24A at this time, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 308A. And I'll open that public hearing. And why don't we start out with District Attorney Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the District Attorney for Deschutes County, and I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee and the association itself in support of Senate Bill 308. Primarily, the bill, as the district attorneys supported it, would provide some victims protection against the disclosure of their financial information in discovery documents that are provided to the defendant's attorney and through the defendant's attorney to the defendant or directly to the defendant. There would be a requirement that information concerning financial information, as that information is, or as that is defined in the financial information statute, would be prohibited from being disclosed. This originates from an original case, or a case down in Jackson County. Jackson County District Attorney Mark Huddleston asked that this bill be a priority bill for the District Attorney's Association. And that case in Jackson County resulted when the information on that contained personal financial information of a victim was delivered to a defendant who was in jail. And that defendant, while in jail, spread that financial information amongst his buddies outside the jail and in the jail, and the victim was re-victimized on a number of different occasions, becoming, I guess, their accounts being raided and credit being affected, and goes to identity theft as well. We believe it's a good bill and ask for your support. There have been some amendments to the bill, which, strictly speaking, are extensions for statute of limitation in some eco-terrorism-type crimes, and District Attorney's Office and Association has no position on those and really aren't here to talk about those.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. We'll have counsel take us through the amendments. Before we get there, though, let's first focus on the purpose of the bill as it was sent over to us from the Senate. Are there questions for Mr. Dugan about the Senate version of 308 in its current form?
Oh, that's easy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't like myself. I think we're catching up.
Oh, I darn.
They're a little slow after lunch, Mike. I got to give them a chance to sort of get caught up. So.
And Mr. Chair gave us an extra 30 minutes, and so that really set us off. Mike, on the back page, on lines 22 is where it defines personal financial information. I mean, I have not looked at the actual definition as to what that would include. Is there, and I don't know if there's anyone else that's going to be testifying on this.
There is. There are two more witnesses.
The only thing I'm wondering is, in preparing a defense, are we somehow limiting them, meaning the defendant, from being able to have conversations with their attorneys on some type of charge that may include personal financial information as part of the charge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I believe the bill as written also allows that information to be disclosed upon order of the court if there is no other way to obtain the information necessary for a defendant to present a defense. And there's some protections in the court order proceeding. The definition of financial information is taken from the identity theft statute, which is previously adopted by the legislator, I think in 2001.
Thank you.
And counsel, do you want to enlighten us on the definition?
I will. And Mr. Chairman, I passed it out. You might have it in your file from last time, but what it does is personal identification is defined in identity theft. So that's definition is from the identity theft definition of personal identification, 165-800-4B, and I'll go through it. And I will note that there is an exception for a name or photograph of a victim or a witness for obvious reasons when there's would have to know who the victim, or excuse me, the witness is, or there were photographs of, say, a victim showing injury. But personal identification includes a person's name, address, or telephone number, a person's driving privileges, person's social security number or tax ID number, person's citizenship status or alien identification number, a person's employment status, employer, or place of employment, the identification number assigned to a person by a person's employer, the maiden name of a person or a person's mother, the identifying number of a person's depository account at a financial institution or a credit card account, a person's signature or a copy of a person's signature, a person's electronic mail name, electronic mail signature, electronic mail address, or electronic mail account, a person's photograph, which has been taken out, a person's date of birth, and a person's personal identification number.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
Is that all in 4B?
Correct.
Well, that's a lot more than financial information. The language of this bill discusses personal financial information.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Sherrill, what this has is they've taken this made a definition of personal financial information that basically leaked into all the what is defined as personal identification in 800,
165-800. Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
Well, it seems like for clarification, we either got to call this personal identification information or come up with a better definition of personal financial information that is that actually tracks with the statute that we're incorporating.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Dugan.
Thank you.
We may have you back up here in just a minute to talk. Why don't we now bring Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose this bill mostly because of the fiscal impact it's going to have on the defense bar. If you've ever looked at a stack of discovery on any case, let alone an identity theft case or a forgery case, the list of information that you just heard is listed in numerous places throughout the report. So we have clerical staff that have to go through the reports and look for all of this information, white it out, make sure that it's all whited out, then make a photocopy of that report so that we can do what we're required to do, which is provide a copy of the discovery to our client. So that takes the time that we will need to train these people. We have clerks right now that white out the names and or the contact information of witnesses and victims that we're currently required to do. But now we're going to have to train them to look for all of this information and white it all out from the discovery. So we are concerned about that increased burden, especially at a time when we are sort of cut to the bone in terms of resources. And I do believe that there's a fiscal attached to this, which appears to be minimal, and at least in speaking with the director of the Public Defender's Office in Multnomah County, where I work, he disagreed with how minimal that impact would be. And I think that just going through that definition should pretty much illustrate for you the number and kinds of information that we're going to have to be going through on these reports.
That's true. Representative Shirley.
Well, Kelly, I guess I'm not sure. I look at 2A, sub 2A, lines 27 to 28 of the first page of the bill. The restriction on disclosure here is placed on the DA. Where does it fall in for you to do the excising or the redacting of information here? Because this says, oh, I see, if they're not represented by a lawyer.
Right.
Oh, okay.
They're required to disclose that information.
I see. And so where does it fall on you?
It falls on us to a, if you look at the beginning, shall disclose to a represented defendant the following material. It says if they're not represented by a lawyer.
Right.
Kelly, Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's on page 2, line 10, which starts unless authorized by the trial court to disclose.
Okay.
So this would be the bulk of them where there is a criminal defense attorney representing.
So we're just concerned about that burden.
Okay. Is that it, Kelly?
Yep.
The other questions? Okay. Now, we should have had you all come up together. We may still. Ann Christian. Mr. Dugan was for, Ms. Skye was against, and Ms. Christian, you have noted you are neutral.
I am neutral, Mr. Chair. Right. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm Director of Indigent Defense Services Division, and I'm here just to shed some light on the fiscal impact statement because, as all of you are aware, it's difficult to do fiscal impact statements, and it's less difficult to do fiscal impact statements when, for example, a Class A misdemeanor is being enhanced or elevated to a Class C felony, where we can get the information with regard to the number of cases, take the number of cases, and take it times the amount of the additional cost to public defense. But I did, for the record, Mr. Chair, want to make a short presentation with regard to the fiscal. And, of course, I arrived without the detailed fiscal that I submitted to Legislative Fiscal Office. But what we did with this situation, because defense attorneys, when the original statutes were passed with regard to defense attorneys redacting addresses and other more generic personal information from police reports. We had many defense attorneys report to us the adverse impact on their offices of that, and I believe that was maybe 4 years ago. So when presented with this, we did talk with some of the public defenders, and I can tell you that the largest public defender, Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland, reported their estimate that the impact of just the part of the bill with regard to the redacting information would be the equivalent of 3 new legal assistants in that office. That public defender is the largest, the second largest in Lane County, estimated an additional 2 trial assistants. If you only take that, and those two represent 2 out of 86 contractors in the state, a grand total of 5 legal assistants at about an average, and again, I don't have my details, but it's about $24,000 per year for a legal assistant, would clearly put the fiscal impact over the $50,000 limit. So we looked at it from a different approach as well. And we looked at the number of identity theft cases, other theft-related cases, and person felony cases. And I do know that Theft 2 misdemeanor cases also would be subject to this bill because there's no limitation. But we really did kind of the most conservative approach. And what we assumed is of the person felonies and the identity theft and other felony theft related, if the additional workload to a trial assistant for a contractor were only an additional 5 minutes, what would the impact be? And if it were an additional 10 minutes, and in the legislative fiscal office's estimate, that's what they have included, which on a statewide basis gives you a range of $36,000 to $72,000 for a full biennium. So this is an area where there is disagreement. I don't know the answer as far as the actual impact.
Okay. Regardless of the yeah, I know and if you add more things to the list, because they're already doing some redacting, so
right.
If you add more to the list, that's more to redact, so there's going to be some additional time there.
Correct.
It's probably hard to measure. And theoretically, pages that wouldn't otherwise now have had stuff that would have had to been whited out and copied again will not have to be whited out and copied again, so there'll be some additional sort of paper shuffling and copy machine time and all that kind of stuff. What do you think the relationship is to the length of the list of things that you have to look for versus, in other words, if you look at Representative Shetterly's point, which mm-hmm. if you tie back to that statute, and I just sort of made a list here on the bottom of the bill, I mean, you know, driving privilege information, citizenship status, an employment status issue. Not all of that information is necessarily what we call personal financial information.
Right.
But it is information that, you know, when some of it, when you take it all together, you can potentially try to do something with. But if we limited that to the stuff that is, in fact, more financial, the Social Security number, the tax ID number, you know, bank accounts, mother's maiden name, signatures, that kind of stuff that would be typically used in an identity theft. Does lowering the list of things that would be included really ultimately have any impact on the fiscal? Because it's still somebody sitting there with a bottle of whiteout having to turn each page of that information over and look for the information they got to redact.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think there's, as with so many things, there's the basic cost of having to have a trial assistant even look at the police report. And then I would suggest that police reports differ from county to county, but thinking back to some in Multnomah County, basic information as far as victim's address tends to be in one place on every police report. And so to the extent amount of information tends to always be in one place, I would think that makes it easier for a trial assistant to white out. To the extent the list gets longer and you wind up with information that would be in the narrative of a police officer's report, witnesses, and their Not address, because that's already covered, but a social security number is a good example. Then I think you're getting incremental additional impacts of time. So I do think, to answer your question, the longer the list, obviously the more time, because one has to be very careful to read through all of the police report for a list of 15 things, as opposed to current law where a trial assistant is keen on, I think it's just two things for both the victim and the witness. I think it's an area where, you know, where we will differ as far as fiscal impact, and I don't want to suggest that I'm saying the defenders are wrong in their estimate. I mean, to me, they probably know best. But I have no way to really quantify that. I do want to say that our fiscal, even with what I put in my fiscal report, that I viewed the 5 or 10 minute estimates per type, per case that we looked at, as being very, very conservative. And even with that conservative approach, it's a range exceeding 50,000.
Okay. Questions for Ann?
Maybe
Representative Barker.
I think maybe more of the district attorney. My question, maybe Ann can answer it. But
why don't we go ahead? Why don't you come up, Mr. Dugan? You can stay put, Ann.
In trying to kind of put this in perspective, we talk about a range of costs from 36 to 72,000. What kind of costs are we looking at one identity theft case to the innocent person in the bank?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's difficult to quantify, because some people who suffer identity theft lose an entire amount of credit. Their credit rating is destroyed, and putting it back together is really difficult. There have been several civil lawsuits over that, and the credit companies, the cost, the simple cases, the cost of just canceling your credit cards and get a new bank account is probably the cheaper part, as opposed to the credit damage and reputation damage.
Mr. Dugan, I know that it was probably legislative counsel expediency that pulled the definition out of 165.800 sub 4 sub B. But what's your thought about all of that information and the definition of personal financial information, since some of it is, you know, arguably, driving privilege status may not necessarily be...
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. And the answer, I suppose, is that actually I typed up the on my computer the recommended language that was shipped over to Legislative Council for the LC draft. So I think I drew that up.
Were you the one that gave us the linkage then to the other statute?
I did.
Oh, okay. Well, good. We'll blame you.
Yeah, you can. in reality, though, Mr. Chair, all of that information is never usually going to be included in every report. If it's a criminal case that has something to do with the victim's criminal history, yeah, we'll provide a criminal history, and oftentimes the driving record is available to the criminal defense attorneys through the DMV. And what we're if it involves that type of issue, but not every case involves a driving issue, so most of the cases aren't going to have that type of information. What we're trying to do, though, is be consistent with the identity theft statutes in defining what personal financial information is across the board. And while Representative Shetterly is correct, some of it isn't financial, many of this stuff can be used to acquire financial information of the victim. Certainly, Social Security number in and of itself isn't financial information, but having access to the Social Security number could give you access to other credit information and credit numbers and other information that can be used to obtain the identity of the victim. Well, I think just keeping consistency with what our law currently is makes some sense, and that's why I dropped that reference in there.
Do you have any objection, since some of it isn't directly, at least, financial information, dropping the word financial out of the definition and just defining it as personal information?
and then linking back to the statute.
I would have no objection to that, Mr. Chair.
And I guess the only the part that seems a little misleading is as you read the definition in 4a, it says personal financial information includes but is not limited to the information specified. And then you get over there, and we call it something different in the identity theft statutes. You look at them, and it doesn't necessarily add up unless you can follow the logic around the way you did when you drafted it. I'm just wondering if that's maybe one way to make it at least jive a little bit better.
Mr. Chair, it may, but I've found that reading a lot of statutes, the title doesn't necessarily reflect what the law says.
True. But we like to do better work in this committee.
Thoughts, comments, questions?
I have a question. So what you're saying is don't say personal financial, you say personal information so we can protect the victim.
Right.
Less confusing.
I think if you read it, you're not surprised when you finally turn to what that actually constitutes and find stuff that you wouldn't otherwise necessarily assume was financial information.
I do have concerns about the indigent defense being, I know they don't have money, but I'm going to weigh on this one. I'm weighing in on the side of the victims, I think, or the potential victims.
Representative Ackerman, do you have a comment? Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly answer Representative Barker's question with regard to the social impact, I think is what you were saying, or the entire impact. The impact is incredible, and I've always wished that fiscal impact statements could include the social impact. But there is one thing that I failed to say is in the legislative fiscal impact, they indicate that district attorneys sometimes redact the information. Frankly, I was surprised to hear that. And to the extent they can assist in this effort, and the bottom line effort is to prevent this personal information getting to those who would do bad things with it. So to the extent the DAs can help, or to the extent we can have a provision that the district attorney's offices or somehow the counties help facilitate not providing or giving an extra copy redacted to the defense attorney. I kind of have a personal interest in that because for so many years we've been asked for how to save indigent defense money. And in 1993, I think it was laughed at. But I think someday we'll get to the point, maybe not in the next decade or something, although I wish otherwise, to have technological ways to deal with these issues. And one would be that, and it is happening in Malheur County, where the police reports are being made available to the defense attorneys electronically. And for certain of those fields I referenced, date of birth, social security number, I would think that we would get to the day where this would not be as time-consuming. So if there's anything that can be done to encourage the DA's Association or the counties to try to assist in this effort, I think that would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may respond just briefly. Of course, the District Attorney's Association and Public Safety Coalition has emphasized a wish to the legislatures to not shift costs, and I think Ms. Christian has asked you to shift costs to the district attorneys, and we would not be willing to do that. But I do agree with her comments with regard to the electronic communication. That's coming. It's going to be here sooner or later in some cases, but it's certainly coming. And as soon as we have that available, I think Lane County, if I'm not sure, Ms. Skye was indicating earlier that Lane County has that capability in their public defender's office already, where they scan it and they can punch in what they don't want to print, and it redacts it automatically. So,
Mr. Dugan, and I'll let you comment if you need to, Kelly. I understand, though, that some district attorney's offices already do some of the redacting and provide both an unredacted and a redacted set.
Some do.
To protect, essentially, ultimately, is there the responsibility? It's sort of like when I produce documents in a case to the opposing side. If there's information that I don't want them to learn because I'm protecting, essentially, the interests of my client, I don't give them to them and say, redact out all the bad stuff before you give it to your client so my client isn't exposed. I do the redacting and have my staff do the redacting up front, so I know that when I'm giving them the set,
I know that I've taken out everything that I think is of value, and so it doesn't seem an unreasonable request, considering that, you know, part of your responsibility as a district attorney's office is to protect the victim, that that would be done on the DA's side as that's getting handed over to the indigent defense office.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that the chair is correct that it's best practice for the lawyer to be able to do that before they pass the information on. And I'm not sure that every district attorney's office in the state, in fact, I'm almost positive that every district attorney's office in the state is different in its function and how it operates. So I would hesitate to recommend to the committee that they legislate what each DA's office will or will not do in terms of the redaction or the presentation. There's no question about it that best practice would be for the district attorney, perhaps even the elected district attorney personally, to review every report and say this doesn't go and this does. But in practice, it doesn't happen all the way that time, or all the time that way. Excuse me,
Ms. Guy.
I was only going to make the exact suggestion that's been made, and that is that two copies could be provided to defense counsel, one that's already redacted with the information that the district attorney's office doesn't want the defendant to receive, and the other one with full information so that we have the ability to investigate and do our duties. But it would be a cost shifting, I agree. It would be shifting the cost to the county.
I guess it would and it wouldn't, depending on where it's not already being done.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I mean, we can probably try this thing out. If it turns out to be a substantial burden, I think we've got to come back and have a conversation about, you know, and I don't have any, ultimately, I don't have any problem legislating best practices, because I sometimes find in this business, Mr. Dugan, you don't get best practices until you legislate it. Not everybody does what the best thing is. They oftentimes do what the easiest thing is, and that isn't the way we ought to be, you know, running the railroad. So if it needs to be legislated to get people to use best practices, I'm not above doing that. Representative Prasansky.
Mr. Chair, I mean, someone's going to have to pay for this. I mean, the bottom line is, no matter who does it, it's going to cost one side or the other to do it. And this isn't something that's currently being done, so I don't see it per se as a cost shifting. It's a new cost because it's a new procedure that needs to be done. And, you know, the more I'm sitting here listening, I mean, I've always taken the position as a prosecutor that I have a duty to protect the victim as much as I can in giving out personal information. And, I mean, I'm not sure if we shouldn't follow through what the chair is saying as to having the policy of putting it forward. I mean, but the thing is, no matter where it goes, I think Ways and Means is going to have to understand there's a cost here, and if we're going to go through a public policy, that whoever is going to be doing it is going to be needs to be compensated or be able to provide that service. The other part, I guess, is when I read through this bill, what if the, as it's currently written, if the public defender or the defensive bar fails to do this, what's the sanction here? And, I mean, are we setting up a cause of action against those individuals by the individual who feels that they've been wronged? Are they some type of criminal sanctions or what?
Well, I'd just tell you my view is that I think to the extent that we're saying that this is information that needs to be redacted from these reports pursuant to statute, and somebody fails to do it, you've established a statutory cause of potential liability if the information isn't redacted and then is used, and you can trace that use back to this disclosure. And so, yeah, I think there is a potential increased liability, and that's, you know, therein lies part of the question about who's going to be responsible to do it, because ultimately that liability probably falls back on whoever you tell by statute has the final obligation of that information going. So to some degree, you've almost created a standard where even if the district attorney's office hands you a redacted report, you're going to have some obligation to look at it before you just hand it over to the defendant to make sure that it's picked up all the right stuff and all that right stuff isn't, you know, in the one you're giving to the defendant, or you potentially incur liability at that level. So I think you got to acknowledge that. I don't think that's necessarily a reason for not doing it. I mean, I think you still need something to protect the information, but I do think you raise the issue that if somebody doesn't do it and the information gets used, there's potential civil liability associated with the failure to do it. thoughts on that from any of the three of you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Prozanski, we as prosecutors have to provide a complete copy of the report to the defendant's attorney as part of discovery. So whatever we give to the defense attorney initially is going to cover and have all that information. The other copy that we would be giving if we redacted stuff would be the copy that we would believe that the defendant's attorney would give to the defendant. And it's not every defendant that gets a copy of the report. I think they're entitled to it, but I'm not sure what the practices of law are of the defense bar. Some people have it read to them. Some people, I mean, the defendant, of course, knows more about the case than anybody. I don't know how we can ever guarantee that the two reports don't get mixed up somehow and like that. As for liability, I seem to recall, maybe legal counsel can help us out, but I think the victims' rights law provide the not a cause of action for violation of that provision.
That may be true. I don't know. We'd have to look at the statute. So there may be an exception.
And Mr. Chair, in that regard, isn't that with regard to the DA's office or law enforcement, who is required under the constitutional provisions to notify the victim as far as what the victim's rights are under the Constitution?
It may not give protection to the defense bar.
Right. I think it protects law enforcement and the DA.
Mr. Chair, you know, it depends. You mentioned needs to have the complete thing. I just think of Spencer Neal, if I whited out a police report and said, trust me, Spencer, this has everything you need to know, and I didn't take anything else out, there'd be a problem there. So
No, you got to have two. Yeah. I mean, you got to have the completely unredacted version. There's no question that we're not trying to play around with that issue at all. Okay. We've got those issues then to consider, I think. We still want to talk about the amendments, which none of you have a stake in, as I recall.
Nope.
Maybe Ms. Guy?
No, I believe that the amendments took care of our concerns, and we're just not taking a position on them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Counsel, why don't you walk us through the A2s?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the A2 amendments are, I believe, I was not here, Bill Taylor was here for the discussion, but it deals with the statute of limitations. I think originally the bill you had was a separate bill, and it had a crime that it tried to define a crime of echo sabotage. And instead, the A2 amendments would have a 8-year statute of limitations for certain specific crimes that I think we were trying to capture: unlawful tree spiking, which is a felony, and there is a misdemeanor component to unlawful tree spiking, which would be if you're possessing the spikes with the intent to use them. But tree spiking is a felony. Interference with agricultural research is a felony. And then felony research and interference, these are all felonies. We would normally have a 3-year statute of limitations. This would lengthen that to 8.
Okay. So this is essentially the version of that bill that we discussed, which took out the creation of this unspecified crime of eco-sabotage that provided the same statute of limitations impact that it would have provided directly to these particular statutes.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. As I read that, and I think Mr. Taylor read that, and again, I don't know if Kelly must have weighed in on this in the hearing, but that the way they worded that could have hit on a lot of crimes. It could have been criminal mischief. It could have been a lot of things that are done for certain reasons. And so I think that the idea was to, as we always try to do, go back to something that we know what we're talking about, and these are the defined crimes that over the last, I would say, 2 sessions have been enacted relating to the, eco-terrorism or these type of things.
Okay. Questions on the dash A2s. I thought I saw Terry Witt in here earlier. I was going to bring him up and ask him their thoughts about it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Chair,
this sure looks like the direction we said we wanted to go, and I think everyone in the room was in approval, in agreement with that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McPherson.
I probably was, but I'm trying to recall what I was in agreement with. I remember there was an interaction with the RICO statute, and if counsel could refresh my memory about that piece of this.
That's already done.
You want to do that, counsel?
These crimes are already in RICO.
Oh, so that was it.
Correct.
Yeah. You don't need RICO once you've identified these crimes by specific reference.
Okay.
That was the issue, is that you could not have to muck around with RICO and not have to create an unspecified something dealing with eco-sabotage that was really just an extension of the statute of limitations. You could link it directly to the crimes that were already on the books that were currently RICO statutes, and then it's just essentially an extension of the statute of limitation period for those designated offenses.
I guess the piece is still missing for me is what's the rationale for taking these particular crimes and adding 5 years to the statute of limitations as opposed to other...
There is
okay.
I shouldn't say that.
No, I don't know that. I don't know
well,
go that far.
I mean, Representative isn't saying that. I mean, what they said on the record was they think that it takes law enforcement more time potentially to be able to do the investigations and bring these people to justice based on the type of network that they could be involved in, how they may be able to hide their conduct for a longer period of time. I mean, it really does come down, Mr. Chair, I think, to the balancing of whether or not we should set up special statute of limitations for these type of crimes as compared to others that I think would warrant just the same. I mean, it really comes back to having an interim or maybe even the law commission looking at looking at statute of limitations as a whole and looking at our criminal code. It has not been updated since 71. And you continue to see layers and layers and layers added. And for many people, as Representative McPherson would ask, is, you know, what's the rationale for it?
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of the rationale in these kind of cases is where they talk about these people can do that and stop and hide. The normal RICO events, robberies and those kind of things are ongoing because the people need to continue earning the money from those, you know, activities. And I think that's why you don't need as long. This is where somebody can do something, wait 5 years, do something else, and so on. Like, I mean, they're not driven by the need to refresh the bank, so to speak. Like, you know, I mean, bank robbers, or you get a prolific bank robber, pretty soon the FBI will say he's going to hit next Tuesday because they can figure out when the guy's going to run out of money from the last robbery. You can. Those are much more predictable than these so-called eco-terrorist crimes, where somebody might do some damage and then go undercover, move away for a while, wait till they could wait for a few years to come back and do it again.
I guess to me that's giving these individuals much more credit than I would think they deserve.
Yeah, it probably is. they just don't need to continually act. As you would in robbery or drugs or something else, or you're...
Well, we are in a unique position, committee, because, as you all know, Representative Jensen is attending the funeral of his grandson today, and both Representative Crummell and Representative Anderson are also attending the funeral to support Representative Jensen. So we are at a...
disadvantage.
Almost a bare minimum. Not a bare minimum, but almost a bare minimum for moving anything forward. It would be the chair's intention to adopt the A2s if the committee was supportive, and I would amend the A and gross version of Senate Bill 308 simply by the reference that I had made earlier, striking the word financial and just having it be personal information, including the definition in sub 4 sub A that personal information includes but is not limited to, and then leaving the definition the same way. Representative Sherrill.
Well, if I can just, there's one other aspect of that, if you wanted to go that, but is not limited to. I guess if we're putting the onus on a legal assistant to make a determination of what needs to be redacted, a definition that says it includes but is not limited to is a problematic definition, I think. It seems to me if we're going to, in understanding now how this works, if you've got folks that are, you know, functionaries in the office, having a list of things is one thing, but saying, but is not limited to, really puts them in a position of having to make judgment calls, I think, when you have that expanded kind of language in that word.
Mr. Dugan, what do you think if we strike out the "but is not limited to" line?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I believe that that language is in the statute that it's referenced, and that's how it came to be in this.
Although that is ultimately for a different purpose. I mean, the statute related to the identity theft crime includes personal information that a person could obtain to actually commit the crime. Here, we're essentially giving guidance to people who are responsible for having to redact information, and if we say "but is not limited to," we put them in a situation where they got to make a judgment call. So, while I understand the definition might match the other one, it seems to me that the "but is not limited to," when you're trying to give a bright line test for somebody who has to decide with potential legal liability what is and isn't going to be included in this report, we ought to be defining it in some greater detail and not leaving it to ultimately their discretion.
I certainly understand that, Mr. Chair. And I think that we could probably be fine with that amendment or
so,
that deletion of that language.
So if we say personal information includes, and then we just strike the "but is not limited to" and have it read the information specified.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And this bill, based on the fiscal, I'm going to have to send this bill down to fiscal, or to Ways and Means anyway. So it's going to go down to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I'm more than willing to support the A2. My comment was basically it just seems, from my perspective, a lot of frustration where we do see over and over looking for a special crime or whatever that someone's special interest to get special treatment. Under instead of looking at the bigger picture of the overview of the statutes in their whole. But I do want to bring up the point that you've raised that would represent Jensen not being here and others that aren't here. They all had very strong positions when the bill came before us that we are changing now. And I'm wondering if this is something that the chair wants to move out today or give them the opportunity to reflect on what we now have before us to get their comments. I mean, I will go and vote today, but I'm not sure if that's something.
I didn't get a sense from Representative Jensen that he objected to the direction that we were headed. In fact, I got a sense that he actually was supportive of the idea of sort of using the crimes that we had already recently just adopted and added to RICO in this manner. So I don't envision that being a problem. If it is, we can, find other ways to address it.
Okay.
But it'd be my preference, I think, to try to move this bill today down to Ways and Means if we could.
And Mr. Chair, I would support the A2s as well. I was just as a new member of the body and serving for the first time on this committee, I'm troubled by what seems at times to be a certain incoherence, at least as I perceive it, about the larger scheme of what we're trying to do, and by accretion we are tackling this problem and that problem, and you wonder at some level whether the whole of it starts looks as logical as it ought to.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I think the point you make is an accurate one, Representative McPherson. Hey, now get off the Pioneer Center.
Sorry.
I like that.
Yeah, let's make it 500. That really is
good. I like
500,000.
Mr.
Chair, do you want to...
Representative Shirley, and by the way, I might point out, Representative McPherson, that you're sitting next to the king of the ecoterrorism statutes from the last legislative session. So,
Are we in work session? Or
we are.
Okay, well, do you want to...
Why don't we take a motion first on the dash A2s?
I'll move the dash A2s then into Senate Bill 308.
Representative Shirley moves the dash A2s into Senate Bill 308. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? The A2s are in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley.
I'll make, I think this is where you're going on the conceptual amendments to the A engrossed.
Yes.
On line 27, deleting financial. Are we going to put personal identifying information? Is that what we're going to use?
We could. Tell me what the statute said again.
The statute says personal identification.
Right, identification.
It doesn't even say personal information, right?
You could just call it personal information. Just
that's fine.
Financial.
Strike. Okay, then I move that
maybe that's easier.
Strike. Financial on line 27, page 1. We strike financial information on line... I'm sorry, financial, rather, on line 2 of page 2, strike financial on line 4 of page 2, strike financial on line 12, page 2, strike financial on line 15, page 2, strike financial on line 22, page 2, and also on line 22, following the word includes, strike the comma, and the words but is not limited to, comma. And on line 23, strike financial.
Okay, Representative Shetterly has moved those conceptual amendments as described. Is there any objection to the conceptual amendments proposed by Representative Shetterly? Hearing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Of Senate Bill 308 as amended, including the conceptual amendments to the floor of the DUPAS recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 308 as amended by the A2s and is conceptually amended to the floor with a DUPAS recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did this have a subsequent referral when it came to us?
Did it already have one?
Oh, no. Then I guess the motion is appropriate. Isn't it just two Ways and Means then?
Correct.
Not to the floor, but the Ways and Means?
I think that's right. Either one. I think it works.
Okay. But,
okay. We'll move Senate Bill.
Works. That's my motion.
Senate Bill 308 as amended. By the amendments and the conceptual amendments to the Committee on Ways and Means with a DUPAS recommendation. Discussion? Nancy, call the roll.
Aye.
Excuse.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 308 as amended goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. And that concludes the business we're going to take up today, colleagues. Would remind you, committee party tonight. I have to, unfortunately, for a father-daughter event that I was unaware of, leave no later than about 6:15.
If we could promptly
start at 5 o'clock, we'll do our little
dine
thing and dine. And
yes.
You're welcome to all stay and drink as long as you'd like. We're
adjourned.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually have to go to a...
I'll just take my golf club. The golf club there before 5:30.
There should be no lampshades on the head.
Hospital without.
Even
so.
At 6:15, right?
I went home.
Oh, that was a good night.
No, literally.
My daughter's in the hospital. He got tired of the boys always doing this kind of derby races.
Yeah.
That was getting so tough. And so we had these, you know, filthy... And I'm standing there, and Gina says, "Oh, you've got to remember that on the night of the 12th, Morgan's daddy-daughter kind of dirty." And I said, Morgan was standing right there, and I said, "That's the night my committee did it." And Morgan didn't say anything. And then I went up to her room a couple minutes later, and she had big tears in her eyes.
Oh, I'm your mother's dad, isn't
it? Oh! So...
Okay, we're